Today on the 21st, it's never too early to prepare for tax season, and we have some financial planners in studio joining us to share tips. Do you have a question? Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455 or tweet to 21st Show. We'll also meet the director, a musician, and the scholar who's adapted one of the oldest known medieval comic dramas, The Play of Adam.
Then Adam will eat part of the apple. And when he has eaten, he will immediately understand his sin.
From that drama to another, the mayor of Metropolis, Illinois, joins us, Billy McDaniel.
It is very gratifying to me to be the mayor of the only home of Superman, Metropolis, Illinois.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. For those of you who are super organized about your finances, maybe you're all ready to go to file your taxes next week. That's actually the earliest you can file. For the rest of us, it's a good time to be getting ready for the April 18th deadline. We'll talk about later why that's April 18th instead of the 15th. Today, we've got two financial planners with us to go over tax-related questions we've been getting from listeners. We've been talking to you about this on social media. You can join our conversation live now as well. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet. Our handle is 21stshow, 21st show. In studio with me here in Urbana is Jake Keebler. He's a certified financial planner with Bluestem Financial Advisors in Champaign. Hey, Jake, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Nyla. Great to be here.
On the line with us from Peoria, from our partner station, WCBU, is Daryl Daggett. He's with Savant Capital Management there. Daryl, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us as well.
Well, thank you for having me.
Again, that number for us to call is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to us at 21st Show. Let me start by asking you both this question. Jake, let's start with you. What's the number one problem you see with people for tax season in terms of what people are not ready for or prepared for?
Well, certainly organization is always a problem for everyone. You know, this is not a particularly exciting topic, and being proactive in this area is not always our first line of thinking. And then sort of right after that, and I would say of equal importance, is I think a lot of people approach tax time as a thing to do in March or April, and they forget that tax planning is really something that should be happening year-round. And so the problem is thinking of taxes as something that you do at the end of the year instead of being proactive and planning for what's upcoming.
And doing it all year. Daryl, what about you? Do you think organization is the biggest problem folks have with taxes?
Yes, I agree with that. That seems to be the biggest issue we have is individuals bringing in a plastic bag full of receipts and trying to decipher what's what and trying to keep it organized. And also, a lot of times after you start working through some of the stuff, you find that they made a lot of mistakes the prior year for the coming year and trying to get them organized on how to look at things a little differently.
Daryl, how do you suggest people get ready?
I suggest individuals set up little file folders throughout the year. So this is a good time to do it as you're preparing for next year. Set up a folder for interest paid, for donations, and have just a little manila folder. And as you go through the year and you donate something, put that in there. You'd be surprised how many of those get lost throughout the year and you don't get to take advantage of those deductions.
Jake, I feel like I'm really good at the online portion of this. I have an electronic folder that's like bills, money, taxes, and all of those things that I know I need to pay attention to. I kind of dump in there. I feel like I'm not so great at the actual paper ones. Daryl, to your point, I think there are a lot of receipts that get lost.
Right.
Jake, do you have a system? How do you suggest people figure out a system that works for them? Because people are doing both electronic and paper.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, most of our clients do very similar to Daryl. I mean, analog just seems to work really well. But for the more tech-savvy people, there are some great systems that you can do to try to get yourself organized. There's things like Mint.com or other online systems to sort of keep track of your expenditures. And if you set it up right and categorize things, it's really great. At the end of the year, you just print the reports and it'll kind of lay out your charitable deductions and whatever other items you may need to have organized for the year end.
So let's go very basic. What kind of categories does everyone need to be talking about, Jake? Daryl mentioned a couple already, right? Obviously, tax deductible contributions. What else do people need to be keeping a handle on?
Yeah, it can really vary. It depends on your tax situation. For most individuals, it's going to be your itemized deductions, so charitable gifts, maybe some unreimbursed employee expenses, things like that. A lot of items tax-wise are going to come to you reported by, you know, your employer, your bank, financial institution are going to report those income items to you. So it's usually more up to you to keep track of the deduction type items. So those charities, the unreimbursed expenses, those sorts of things.
Daryl, to Jake's point, do you have an estimation for how much money people are leaving on the table each tax season, money that we are basically giving to the government because we're not claiming it back or figuring out our proper deductions?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've not read anything on it, but there's a lot of commercials out there that are saying there's well over $1 billion being left on the table.
Wow,
so
okay.
It's a lot of money that is being left out there.
You know, and to that point, Daryl, to your point, Jacob, to your point about employee reimbursement, we have been talking to people on social media this week about what questions they have, and I want to get to a couple of those. If you have questions, you can call us. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to us at 21st Show. Daryl, one Reddit user asked us about employee reimbursement, and they said if your employer reimburses you for work-related driving, for example, but pays lower than the federal reimbursement rate, say your employer gives you 20 cents per mile, how do you cover that in your taxes? Is that something you should be keeping track of?
Definitely. You want to keep track of all your mileage that you're not reimbursed for and itemize those amounts. Also, any medical mileage that you would put on if you're going to claim any medical itemization amounts, you want to make sure you can include that in. And, you know, if you're self-employed, make sure you're keeping track of all that mileage as well.
Yeah, we had a lot of questions about from people who were self-employed that I want to get to in a second. But let me ask the kind of the big question that we got from a couple people. And Jake, I wanted to ask you this. This was from an independent contractor. He was saying, in what case would you, what kind of things, rules of thumb do you suggest for people in terms of people who do want to do their taxes themselves, do it online, use TurboTax or whatever, versus seeing somebody and paying a professional such as yourself to do it?
So when's the right time to hire a professional?
Yeah, or what point do you think, what kind of questions or guidance do you provide for people in terms of when does it get so complex you think, maybe I shouldn't do this myself?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it would initially come down to just comfort level. When you prepare your own taxes, even if you're using tax software, you need to understand the basics of the forms and kind of what should you expect the end result to look like. And there are lots of great publications on the IRS website, they call them pubs, where you can look up if you want to learn more about a specific form or schedule that you're needing to file. If those things are not something that you enjoy doing, or you feel like you're sort of wading into topics that maybe you don't fully understand what you should be doing, certainly that's a good time to bring in a professional. The problem with doing it on your own is sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and so you may not realize that you're missing items. It wouldn't be uncommon for us to take a look at a tax return for someone that prepared it themselves and maybe find out that they were missing some deductions they didn't know they were entitled to, or maybe reporting some things incorrectly. And so sometimes what you find is if you hire a professional, you may end up getting more back in, you know, missed deductions or taking better opportunity of things that you're entitled to that more than pay for the fee that you pay to that professional.
Which you can also deduct in your next year's returns, right?
Possibly. There are some limitations on that deduction.
And Jake, you're also an enrolled, so you're a certified financial planner. You're also an enrolled agent with the IRS. What's that and what does that mean?
So the enrolled agent is an additional sort of education and certification with the IRS that basically says that I have a certain level of knowledge regarding individual and business tax, and therefore I can represent my clients in front of the IRS. So if there's an audit issue or other things come up, I can work directly with the IRS on any sort of client. So it's sort of like the CPA, but a little bit more focused on tax in particular, where the CPA is a little broader. It's got audit and public accounting and those sorts of things. The enrolled agent's just a more sort of focused on tax alone.
That's Jake Keebler. He's a certified financial planner, as you've been saying, and an enrolled agent with Bluestem Financial Advisors. He's here with me in Urbana and Peoria. Daryl Daggett is with us. Daryl's with Savant Capital Management. And Daryl, you're a certified financial planner as well. We actually found you through the Illinois Financial Planning Association. What questions do people need to ask of whoever's preparing their taxes to make sure they're qualified to do that?
normally we tend to let people know they should probably be dealing with a CPA when it comes to doing their taxes if they're going to be paying for it. Those individuals are educated and trained on doing the taxes.
A CPA, okay. Now, Jay, can you explain the deadline is April 18th instead of the 15th, so everyone has three extra days? Why do we have three extra days this year?
That's right. It's three extra days, but I still wouldn't recommend procrastinating. So generally, your due date of your tax return is always the 15th day of the fourth month following the end of your tax year. So actually, not everyone has a 12/31 end of tax year, but for probably 99% of individuals, they do. So that effectively means April 15th is generally the deadline. However, this year, the 15th falls on a Saturday. Therefore, they automatically extend one extra day till Monday, although in this year, that Monday also happens to be Emancipation Day in Washington, D.C., and therefore, D.C. holidays are considered national holidays, and therefore, you actually get one even additional day, so it pushes out to Tuesday the 18th this year.
Okay. Well, that's why everyone has until the 18th. Daryl, for people who are doing taxes online, lots of people, I know every year we see a growing amount of people who are e-filing, doing everything electronically. What do people need to know about security in terms of e-filing?
With e-filing and with the security systems, when you talk to a lot of these CIOs, information officers of companies, a lot of times they'll tell you it's not if, but when you're going to get hacked. And so you want to be very careful in putting information out there that you shouldn't. So a lot of this software is fairly good. It's very easy to use and kind of walks you through it. But you want to be very careful when you are filing it that you're making sure it goes through the right channels and that you're not going out on a website you're not familiar with and filing it through the software's programs if you're using electronic.
And there's lots of scams during tax season, too. Are there common ones that you recommend your clients be very careful of, Daryl?
We've seen a lot of scams. Number one would be the IRS will not call you. And we see that happen a lot of times where people will receive a telephone call, and especially the elderly. They'll get very frustrated with it and will give information that they probably shouldn't be giving. You should never give your Social Security number to anyone that you don't know who they are, especially somebody that's initiated the call to you. You want to make sure you know who you're talking to. Make sure you do not use any electronic format to send a Social Security number. That's probably the easiest way they're going to obtain it. If you're going to send a form, make sure you either secure the form with a password or fax the information over to an institution if you need to send information. A lot of times we'll see that with the tax preparers. They'll need additional information, and people will scan that and email it, and that's usually the easiest way for somebody to hack in and get that information.
Jake, what should you do if you get a notice from the IRS, which again, as we're saying, it would not come by phone. I don't even know if it would come via email, but it would definitely come in the mail.
It'll definitely come in the mail. So I think the first thing to do is just take a deep breath. I know even just for me, and I'm familiar with this, you know, you get something and the return address says Internal Revenue Service or Illinois Department of Revenue, and it sort of, your heart starts beating a little faster, the blood pressure goes up. So first of all, just take a deep breath. A lot of times these notices are either informational, it's just telling you something happened, or it's just a very small administrative item. So If you're comfortable with your tax situation, review the letter, understand what's going on, and then respond to it as appropriate. If it's something that you're not very comfortable with, you're using a tax professional, the number one thing is get the letter to your tax professional as soon as possible so that they can help you deal with it. That's probably the number two or three issue that we see with clients are they get a notice from the IRS, they throw it in a drawer, and they bring it in with their tax materials 6 or 8 months later when the IRS says we need to hear back from you in 2 to 3 weeks or we're going to assume that the changes we made are correct and therefore you owe us more money.
Right. So that's a number one is open the letter. Daryl, right. That's a good one. Daryl, can I ask you, we got a question on Reddit. A user asked, do I need to pay quarterly taxes? In what situation would someone want to do something like that?
In the event that you're not having enough taken out of your paycheck to cover your tax liability for the year. If you're safe harbored in, there's nothing to worry about. But in the event of if you're receiving, you know, a lot of quarterly dividends or you have farmland where you're receiving, you know, income on a quarterly basis, you want to make sure your tax preparer is looking that over to make sure you don't have any penalty for underpaying your taxes throughout the year.
Can we move to the issue of refunds in terms of how I know that how quickly do we expect to see how much could you expect to see your tax refunds when you get them back if you are due a refund? Jake, I know the IRS has a pretty handy chart they normally have online, and I know you can even just go in online and check. Is that system, I know that system worked last year. Is that how things will work this year as well?
I believe the plan is to have that up this year, but I actually have not checked.
Okay.
But I think the number one thing that I'd warn about with refunds are with the rising prevalence of identity theft around taxes, the IRS has had multiple situations where they suspect identity theft and refunds get held up while the IRS processes this. So, for example, we've seen clients whose refund have been delayed up to a year while the IRS sorts out who the true taxpayer is. So we definitely don't recommend counting on refunds to, for example, fund a vacation, pay down debt, or even, you know, pay your real estate taxes, because in some cases, if you're the victim, you may end up being the one on the hook until the IRS can really sort out who the right person is.
Darren, last question for you. What point can you go to the IRS for help or for information? What resources do you think are available for people?
The resources through the IRS,
yes.
IRS.gov is a good place to start. You can actually call in Peoria. There is a local IRS office you can reach out to and go in person or telephone call. There's also some toll-free numbers that are available on IRS.gov that you can call in. I think the wait time this year, they're saying, is going to be about 12 minutes on average is what they're looking at for this tax preparation period. And for the professionals, it'll be about 7 minutes. There's a separate number for tax preparers to call in on. So, Jake said earlier, allow plenty of time. Start doing your taxes early, gathering your information now. Some of your information may not be available until middle of March if you have commodities or K-1s coming, and you need to be aware of that.
It's a good time to start preparing now and thinking about it. I want to thank Darrell Daggett joining us from our partner station WCBU in Peoria. He's at Savant Capital Management. Thanks also to Jake Keebler with Bluestem Financial Advisors in Champaign. Thanks for being with me, guys.
Yeah, absolutely. It's great to be here.
Listening to the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. That's the story of Adam and Eve become new again in the form of a very old piece of theater. The play of Adam is one of the oldest European medieval comic dramas that we're aware of. It takes you from the story of the Garden of Eden all the way up to the Christmas story. It was written in the vernacular, and this modern adaptation, translated and written by University of Illinois history professor Carol Symes, is no different, complete with references to nasty women in the upcoming Women's March on Washington. After a premiere in New York over the holidays, it's being staged this weekend in Urbana at the Chapel of St. John the Divine on the University of Illinois campus this Thursday through Saturday. We'll tweet out the information. We'll post it at our website. In studio with me now is Carol Symes, along with Kyle A. Thomas, the stage director, and Drew Minter, the play's music director and composer. Carol, Kyle, Drew, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Carol, so this is the oldest European play we know of in vernacular, the language of the people. How long did it take you to adapt this to today's language, to modern times?
Oh, I spent a whole summer working on this, and then for years afterward tweaking it. But it's really only now when hearing it performed and working with the actors that I really feel like it's finished, in the sense that I now know that it's actable and entertaining. And that was something that I had always striven for, but I wasn't sure I could attain it. So this has been a really great moment for me.
And it's in rhyming verse. I'm thinking of a line I wrote down when I was watching last night. If you, for example, so this is a discussion in the Garden of Eden. If you eat from the apple of the tree, you'll reign in majesty, you'll be divinity. Was that the style at the time to also be in rhyming verse?
Yeah. In fact, rhyming verse was new when this play was written. Rhyme as a feature of poetry really only is invented in the 11th century and in old French dialects like that of the play of Adam. So the play really rejoices in the sonority of that rhyme. The problem is that, as most folks know, English is a much different language than French, and whereas there are so many words in French that rhyme very easily, it's much harder to translate those rhymes into English. So I really had to struggle quite a bit to because I wanted to keep the exact original rhyme schemes of the play, and that was one of the biggest puzzles for me.
So, Kyle, this is staged in a church. Why?
Well, originally, the stage directions included with the play talk about performing it in front of a church, and it's a little too cold this time of year for that. So we just premiered the Carol's translation at the Cloisters, the Met Cloisters in New York, as a part in their 12th century Fuente Dueña Chapel. And lovely space, just absolutely gorgeous. And it was really cool to be in a space that is roughly contemporary with the play itself. And the interior spaces of the church work beautifully, just as well as probably the exterior of the church would, too. With the play, we are able to gesture to whether they be sculptures or paintings. You probably saw last night the crucifix, the cross. We make gestures to them as a way to connect what it is we're saying, the biblical nature of it, and our audience there in the space with us to kind of the larger, grander ideas that the play is trying to communicate.
And I think the music of this also lends it to that, what you're talking about, really well. I wanted to play a little bit of what I recorded from the rehearsal I attended last night.
Behold, a virgin child conceived.
Drew, that's you, not just singing, but also composing and directing the trio. You coordinated all the music for this. How did you adapt all of the music for this production?
The play has specific rubrics in it. It's a number of chants that are come from a Sunday of Septuagesima, and these pieces actually are very available and remarkably consistent over several centuries. I looked at several centuries of, they're called antiphonaries, that have these chants in them, and chose the simplest ones and simplified them more for the purposes of our play, partly because they're extremely long, and they were told, we're told in the script, in the original play, that they were sung by a choir. We have three singers. I think a choir can sustain these kinds of melismatic, very long lines better than we can as three singers. But also, I asked Carol if she would translate them into the same kind of nice, more vernacular sort of English, so that we would be able to match in that way. But the material itself is old. So in a way, we're using an old structure and renewing it. Now, what you just heard actually is, I have to make a little bit of a disclaimer about that, because that's actually written in a different style, because it comes at the ultimate moment of the show, when the show turns into a show as these early plays often do, about the birth of Jesus. It's very common for Old Testament stories to become suddenly New Testament stories at the end, as sort of a punchline, that all this is a preparation for Jesus, and that. So we were using that. Actually, in fact, what you just played is an introduction to a much longer piece that the cast sings with us as a sort of finale, musical finale.
So there's a lot of audience interaction with this, right? As you're talking about, Drew, as you're talking about the music and sort of the modern adaptation, Kyle, there's a whole part, especially at the beginning, with the devil. There's a lot of audience participation to sort of play along with the devil. Was that how the original play was? Is it something that you all came up with?
Very likely it was. These were plays that were meant not for clergymen or very wealthy, powerful people, but for the common folks of a town. The church would have been the community center, and likely would have been attached to the center of the town, or a town square of some type that people gathered for all types of religious and civic activity. So there's very strong emphasis on the community and on what people are dealing with on a daily basis. So when Adam and Eve lament having to sow their seeds and fight off the thorns and thistles, it's very much a a call to those people that are doing the same kind of fights in their everyday life. And we really try to bring that in through the use of the devil and getting kids and young people involved to make noise with us. And as you mentioned earlier, we do make some gestures to a lot of what's going on in our contemporary world right now as a means to connect with our community here, not only when we did this in New York, but here at the University of Illinois.
So when you did this in New York, did you pass out buttons for Nasty Women?
We did. We had Nasty Women stickers that we passed out. Lots of noisemakers in this beautiful medieval museum. We were just making as much noise as we could.
And
it was a blast.
And the plan for this production is to include a reference. Did you add the last minute reference to the march, the women's march?
Carol should mention talk about that, because that was her idea.
Yeah, so there's a part in the play where Satan is tempting Eve, and the way she does it in the play is to say, you know, you deserve to be the ruler of this world. You are far smarter and more charismatic than Adam is, and you should be the equal of God. You could be the queen. And that's the moment where we're going to sort of whip out the Nasty Women and
more powerful than no man has ever seen,
exactly.
Or something like that. Yes.
So again, even this play, which is almost 1,000 years old, is already kind of introducing us to the sort of proto-feminist argument about women's power.
And is that in the original?
Oh, yeah.
That's in the original text as well.
I mean, obviously not Nasty
Women. Well, right,
but
the whole notion of
absolutely,
that.
This whole idea that what you know, Satan is a powerful psychologist, and what he figures out about Eve is that she's very smart and she's very ambitious, much more ambitious than Adam, and that's how she tries to make her argument to Eve. So it's a really interesting moment.
So Carol, this is an 11th century play. Is it about 11th century? A little earlier than that?
1100s. So the middle of the 12th century.
Okay. And what do we know about how it was staged, where it was staged, how common it was? What do we know about all of that?
Well, we only have one manuscript, but that's not at all unusual for medieval plays. Most medieval plays are hovering on the brink of extinction. So just the fact that we have one manuscript doesn't mean that it wasn't widely performed. There are all sorts of reasons why these texts wouldn't survive. But as Kyle mentioned, the stage directions in the play are so specific, and they talk about how the devil should interact with the audience. They talk about the importance of engaging the community. So the play really gives us a tremendous amount of information about how the playwright really envisioned it working. And in fact, we've added the playwright as a character in the play to interact with the actors and the musicians, just because the playwright, she seems to be so very present in the script. So really, this is, as Kyle says, we're never quite sure, but the play itself gives us so much information to work with.
And you play the role of the playwright.
I
want to get back to that in a second, but I want to just ask you about, Kyle, so you said originally, and I'm just sort of thinking of the historical context of this, being performed outside a church. Is your sense then that this would have been something that entire communities would have attended? This wasn't something that was just for, as you said, the nobility or the clergy or things like that?
Well, one of the things that when Carol and I actually have been working on this play for a while, and I did a staged reading of it 2 or 3 years ago, and one of the things that Carol has put forward in her research with the play is that this was likely done by just a small number of performers, meaning that it could likely travel anywhere. And so it would have been the kind of thing that would have joined together a lot of smaller communities in a larger regional way. And we don't know, maybe different bits of the show could have been changed a little bit here and there to match with those regionalities. But one of the things that we've shown in our staging of it is that, yes, this with the numerous
right,
characters
really just
that we
four,
have,
there's really four.
There's only four actors.
Right.
It's an
and
ensemble
even though, and
show.
There's 16
different roles,
yeah.
But they play different characters, but they play all the different characters. They're able to make their exits and their entrances and do any costume changes or any props adjusting that needs to be done fairly easily. And we've proven that now twice since the stage reading and now with this production as well. So I very much think, and this is my guess here, is that this would have been the kind of show that a small number of itinerant players could have traveled around the French countryside and hit a few good big, you know, villages here and there, but you know would have adjusted here and there to the different regional perspectives that may have been prominent at the time period, but also kind of bringing them all under larger issues and concerns, both theological, religious, communal, that the play deals with in a much bigger kind of regional sense.
And Drew, would the music also have been something that the style that you, we heard a little bit of it, is that something everybody would have been familiar with as well?
Not really. It would have been educated, well, clerics probably. There would have been a choir, however, at any large cathedral or even church in a regional setting that would have known these chants. And that's why I found it interesting when I started doing the research on the specific pieces that are mentioned to find that actually I looked at settings all the way from Austria to France and 12th to 14th century settings. And even the 14th century settings you would expect to be much more elaborate, but no, they were really pretty codified. So they would have sung probably very close to the same notes. We're just, all we've done is simply tweaked it a little bit. I wouldn't say for modern taste really so much as for convenience of the show, because we are in this kind of set. You know, audiences sit on their hands in a way that I don't believe a 12th century
modern
audience
audiences
did.
Do.
Correct.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
Oh, you know, terrified to be called on and use a rattle.
Right. Medieval
right.
audiences are
we
are
encouraging
rowdy.
Them, but it's very difficult. You know, we're used to going to see theater in a dark room where we don't, you know, if we laugh. Even,
a dark,
you know,
cold room normally,
well,
I would
right.
say.
And one of our neighbors, you know, chides us for even laughing at the show, much less for opening a candy. I think the reception that the audience would have had to this piece and the interaction was clearly more. But the music, I think, is in a way set aside. It's a sort of moment of repose as it, right. I mean, it even looks like that right. in the original.
Yeah, in fact, what the music does, it's so beautiful, is that the music returns us to the sacred story and to the liturgy.
The liturgy.
Whereas the play kind of makes that pop out. Mm-hmm. So there's that liturgical framework that reminds you that we're talking about the sacred story, but the dialogue connects that sacred story to what Kyle was talking about, to the everyday concerns of normal men and women
right.
who are trying to make a living in tough circumstances, dealing with marital issues, you know, dealing with sibling rivalry, you know, so that the play does so many things at once. It tells a sacred story, but it also makes that sacred story completely available to the common person.
I think if we're taking liberties with the music in the show, it's in introducing instrumental music, for which there's no proof. But in a way, Kyle and I were just talking about, last night we had a very fevered discussion about television and film and how important the introduction of music is as an atmosphere, as an atmospheric component to continue the dialogue, to continue the storyline and support that. And I think that's what we've used the music for. The instrumental music doesn't even make an effort to be authentic to the time. First of all, we have extremely little instrumental music written down. So what I'm using that is truly true instrumental music comes from a later source.
So what you've adapted.
So,
you know, we just have a minute or two left. And Carol, I just wanted to ask you what you think the point of staging the play of Adam was in medieval times and how much what you want it to be now.
Mm-hmm. So drama was in the Middle Ages. It was the mass medium of the time. So if you wanted to teach people about politics or involve them in new educational trends, that was the way you did it. And so the play tackles controversial issues. It tackles the fact that many people might not have believed in certain elaborate theological concepts. We have a character in this play who questions the virgin birth, you know, whether that actually happened. In other words, the play stages the kinds of doubts and problems that everyday people have. So that's one of the amazing things that this play does. And at the same time, it gives them beauty. It gives them something, you know, beautiful to listen to and look at. I think in many ways our intent nowadays is no different. We want to engage an audience. We want to fill them with joy and delight. We want to make them think, and we want to collapse the difference that we think exists between ourselves and people who lived in the 12th century, because these are human beings who are smart and hopeful, but also sinful and worried about contemporary events. You know, they're dealing with the same kinds of things that we are, in a way that's slightly so, and so that we're more united by those concerns than divided.
That's the play of Adam. It opens on Thursday. Thanks to Carol Symes, who teaches in the Department of History, Theater, and Medieval Studies at the University of Illinois Place, the playwright, stage director Kyle A. Thomas, music director and composer Drew Minter, who also lectures at Vassar College. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. At the southern tip of Illinois, the small town of Metropolis wears a big badge of honor. If you couldn't tell by that music, 45 years ago this Saturday, it was named the official hometown of Superman by DC Comics. 5 months later, the Illinois Senate passed a resolution confirming it. We're joined now by the mayor of Metropolis, Bill McDaniel. Mayor McDaniel, thank you for joining us on The 21st.
Well, thank you for having me.
What's it like to live in the official hometown of Superman?
It's great. There's nothing like living in a small town like the city of Metropolis that has a superhero that guards us each and every minute of every hour of every day.
So what does it mean exactly that this is the official hometown of Superman?
Well, and not only we take great pride in that because it is only one, but it is an economical incentive for us through our tourism. So there's not very many hours in every day that there's not someone at the town square at the Superman statue taking pictures or buying souvenirs from the Superman Museum, and that goes on, you know, 12 months out of every year, every given day of the week.
Can you tell me more about the Superman statue? I know that's a big attraction in the town.
The Superman statue sits right at the base of our courthouse square. We're like many southern Illinois towns. We actually have a square where you actually can drive all the way around the courthouse. This is the county seat for Massac County. And Superman is looking down our main street of Market Street, where our Uptown Business District is. So, it's a way of life here. We take great pride in that, and I can tell you I don't know of any place I've ever been that when you tell them you're from Metropolis, Illinois, that they don't know that that is the home of Superman.
Well, and Mayor, you mentioned the economic interests. I know that there's a local grocery store that has a sign in it that reads, "Just as Superman stands for truth, justice, and the American way, Food World stands for quality, convenience, and friendly service." Is that pretty much a common standard for lots of businesses in town to adopt? It is.
It is, and we actually have a store on the main entrance on Highway 45 coming into the city of Metropolis. Off the Interstate 24 that is called Big John's, and they actually have a bigger statue than the Superman statue of a man standing with groceries in both arms.
Ah, okay, so a Superman kind of thing.
Yes.
Now, how does it work with DC Comics? How does that relationship look like? Do they encourage you to promote and celebrate Superman?
Yes. And you're actually allowed. Now, they don't have a franchise on the Superman statue. It's an open venue. Anybody, everybody can actually take pictures at the base of that statue. It is actually up on a platform, a brick platform with nameplate bricks, you know, like brick in memory or in honor of of family members deceased. And things of that nature all the way around the base of that statue. It is enclosed with a wrought iron fence around it and then actually has a pedestal on the outside for the visitors to get up on a little 3-foot platform to take pictures.
Oh, okay. So it's set. Now, how does it work with DC Comics? Are they strict with to work with and tell how much you can do with the actual brand of Superman? Like, how does that work with, for example, the museum?
Well, there are certain things that are copyrighted. You're only allowed to sell them. You have to have authorization from DC Comics to sell certain things. And then there's other things that are not copyrighted, you know, like trinkets, cups, shirts, and things like that. So there is plenty of things that can be sold without DC Comics approval.
And
now,
I know
DC Comics does... They guide of what you can use that Superman theme for, you know. Plus, we can only have a true Superman in costume so many times a year.
How many times a year?
Well, it actually runs all the way through the week of the Superman's festival, and that exactly is the second week of June of every year, and it lasts from a Thursday through a Sunday. And it is a we actually block off 4.5 to 5 blocks of Market Street. Actually block it off. You can't drive on it. And it is for the festival with vendors, food vendors, souvenirs, trinkets, you know, homemade
items. Lots of kryptonite
items
on sale.
Yeah, lots of kryptonite. Lots of kryptonite.
On Halloween, would you say there's a higher proportion of Superman costumes in Metropolis on Halloween than there maybe are in other Southern Illinois towns, Mayor?
Probably not, because we're used to it. You know, a Superman. Now, during the Superman Festival, it is a sight to be seen. You will see spandex where you probably oughtn't to see spandex. And the participants from all ages of life, from 80s to, you know, infants, and they'll have the Superman costumes on, Wonder Woman, Batman, you know, all your action heroes during that week. Plus, we have all the costume parties. You know, we actually have a contest for the best dressed Superman, the best dressed action hero, and actually it's quite you know, we give $1,000 in several different categories through that Superman celebration. There's people from all over the world that actually come to the city metropolis and stay. Many of them use it for their vacation. They'll come on a Monday and stay through that Sunday, and they fly in probably from as many as probably 10 to 14 foreign countries, and just about every state in the United States in that week will be represented here through that week.
Do you have a Superman costume, Mayor McDaniel?
I do not, but I have a lot of Superman souvenirs.
Okay. What's your favorite one?
Well, you know, many of the, of course, I'm 72 years old, so I grew up in the Superman era. I mean, I can actually remember watching Superman on television, you know, with your black and white small screen televisions and things of that nature. So I actually have Lois Lane. We actually have a Lois Lane statue here also. Lois Lane, I actually have, when we broke ground for that statue, Lois Lane actually came to the city metropolis. We did the groundbreaking, and the gold shovel that she actually used for that groundbreaking ceremony, I have in my office, and it is signed by Lois Lane. You know, I take great pride in that. We have a lot of little things, you know, with the people that portray Superman and things that you're fortunate. I guess it's fortunate or unfortunate.
Well, and when you say that, yeah.
Many of the people that actually were in the Superman era have passed on. They're no longer alive. So the next generation that kind of took that up was your Smallville. And, you know, that portrays the same thing and things like that. Every time they come out with a different movie of Superman or something like that, it does boost the activity in the city metropolis as far as tourism. And there's probably 25 to 35,000 people that come through the city metropolis for that Superman celebration in that week.
Yeah, Mayor, how do you explain to people, what's the population of Metropolis?
6,500.
And how do you explain to people who think of Metropolis and Smallville and the fact that it's a town called Metropolis, but it's not the big Metropolis in the comics?
The people that actually are really more taken are people from foreign countries, you know, like Japan or someplace like that. They Our largest building is a, you know, a five-story hotel that actually is Harrah's. So, you know, in their minds, when they get here, they think, you know,
it's going to be this
skyscrapers
really big city. Yeah.
And, you know, New York City and D.C. and things like that, which is not. You know, we're just a small river town. You know, Metropolis was actually formed in 1839, and their original name was Metropolis City. And then through legislature in the state of Illinois, they had become the city of Metropolis in May the 4th of 1839. We have a lot of other things that goes along with Metropolis that we're proud of. The Birdman of Alcatraz is actually buried in. He's buried in the city of Metropolis.
Wow.
Which was Robert Stroud. I'm sure, did you ever see the movie?
I did not.
Okay. He is actually buried here in our city, in one of our local cemeteries. And, you know, it's just a, Metropolis is a historical river town. It sits right on the banks of the Ohio River. We're about 6 miles from Paducah, Kentucky. And we're just as far south in Illinois as you can possibly go and still stay in Illinois.
It sounds like it. So, Mayor, can I ask, do you ever get sick of Superman?
No, ma'am. And nor do I ever get sick of the dedicated people, and especially the smaller children. From my office, I can actually see the Superman statue. And it's not uncommon for in the summertime and even in the winter some, more in the summer, I'll get out of my office and walk up there and actually talk to some of the visitors and stuff like that. There is nothing in this world that is more gratifying to me as the mayor of the city of Metropolis to see a young person that has, maybe they've been over to the Superman Museum and they bought a cape, and they're standing alongside Superman, and those 4-year-olds or 5-year-olds will come just about to the top of Superman's knee, and in their own little minds, when they jump off that platform, which is, you know, 3 steps high, they think they're flying.
I bet they've got great expressions on your face. I bet they've got great expressions that you get to see all day while you're working, too.
And even the older people, you know, that actually grew up and they have that fantasy of that Superman era. And it's not unusual for them to wear Superman costumes and things like that in the city of Metropolis during those festivals.
Phil McDaniel is the mayor of Metropolis. 45 years ago this Saturday, it was named the official hometown of Superman. Can I ask what it's like to be the mayor of the official hometown of Superman, Mayor?
Well, my name is Billy McDaniel, and most people in the city of Metropolis call me Mayor Billy. They don't call me Billy. They call me Mayor Billy. And like I said, it is a great, great honor. I was actually in private business here in the city of Metropolis for 32 years. I owned Bill's Barbecue, which my father started in 1965. I retired from that business in 2001 and retired, sold it to a gentleman named Bill. So the legacy of that goes on, and the legacy of the city of Metropolis, the home of Superman, truth, justice, and American way, lives on forever.
Well, Mayor Billy, thanks for taking the time to join us. We appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure.
I am Superman.
All the time we've got today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. All of those links, every other way to contact us, whether it's phone, email, or social media, is all at our website, 21stshow.org. You can follow us on Twitter. Search for 21stshow. We live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on the air, lots of news and information about Illinois. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can also comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.